morning and welcome to the Slippery Slope of Lipids and Other Medical Issues, brought to you by the Triana Prevention Center in Port Charlotte, Florida. This is a live medical talk show in which you're invited to participate. If you have a question or comment along the way, please call us at 941-206-1580 or toll free at 888-441-1580. Once again, that's 888-441-1580. And now, here's your host of the show, Dr. Elizabeth Triana and Dr. Katzen.
Dr. Katzen is our guest today. Good morning, everyone out there. Oh, my goodness. Gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous days, isn't it?
Well, it's been beautiful, yes.
Really beautiful. We could use
a
little rain.
Time to start raining, though.
Yes, we need rain. Don't you think so?
Yep. April showers are supposed to be May flowers. We had very little rain in April, and May is usually the beginning of our rainy season.
The pollen count must be astronomical out there.
It is. Allergies are big time this winter. The allergies have been terrible. Asthma, bronchitis. I have asthma myself, as I have said before. But welcome, Zane. Welcome, Dr. Katzen. Welcome, all of you, to this wonderful and beautiful show that we have for you today. So I'm going to start off by, last week I'm going to just give a little update. I know my patients are coming in are going, how you doing on your low-carb diet? Well, guess what? I've lost 6 pounds.
Yay!
Yay!
That's tremendous.
So,
everybody's happy.
But as I say, it's a drop in the ocean. But still, I feel really good, and I am really sticking to it. And I want to thank all of my patients who come in and ask how I'm doing and are giving me words of encouragement. So I'm sticking to it. I will tell you, the weekend's going to be a little hard.
Especially a holiday weekend.
Yeah, holiday weekends are going to be hard, but I'm going to do it.
So vegetables on the grill.
Yes, vegetables on the grill. That's right.
Eggplant's excellent on the grill.
Lean. Oh, it's delicious. Lean and green. The one thing I did notice, and for all you out there who are in there with me doing the low carb also, I did have some almonds, and those are really hard. It's like it's hard to stop. So just a fair warning, if you're going to have a small snack of almonds, then count them out and maybe put them in a little plastic bag or something. 28 almonds have 160 calories. That's a lot.
Yeah, it is. It takes how long? 15 minutes to burn that off on the elliptical machine.
But I'm just saying, so, you know, portions still count, and it was hard for me, and so I decided, guess what? I'm just not going to have any almonds around for a while.
And then you can do what I do. You rationalize it by saying, I'm getting good fats, so the heck with the calories. I'm getting good fats here.
Yeah, but it's still a lot of calories. So we're going to start off with we have a great show. For Memorial Day, Monday's Memorial Day, and Dr. Katzen is going to talk about the development of battlefield medicine. This is going to be really, really interesting. I know we have a lot of listeners who may have participated in wars or veterans. I do have some patients that are World War II veterans, too, and we're going to talk about this topic, and I salute all of you who have given to our country. As you all know, my uncle passed away, Uncle Tony. He was a Marine. I have friends who and patients who are in the military, and we do salute you all. So what I'm going to start off with is, what body part am I? And, you know, they're getting tougher. They sure are getting tougher. So what body part am I? I am the leader of the orchestra. I am in your brain. I link one system to the next, nervous to endocrine. I produce releasing hormones, and I respond to light, smell, other hormones, stress, and I control the release of 8 hormones. I also work in your temperature regulation. I control your food and water intake, and I also control your circadian cycles. So, what body part am I? If anybody knows, call in. I know it's a little tough, but it is the leader of the band. So call us at 206-1580. And if you have any questions about any issues, any medical issues, please call. You know, we are, our lines are open, right, Zane?
That's right. They're wide open right now. I can tell you whatever the answer is to this, mine is messed up because I'm eating too much and sleeping too little.
Okay, we won't talk about that. So let's start off with our topic. Dr. Katzen, I know you've been working and researching, and you're going to talk about in development of battlefield medicine. Talk to us about that.
Well, battlefield medicine is simply the care of the wounded on the field. Now, the history of man is a history of wars, and people have always been bashing each other up and cutting each other up, and there's always been some people who trying to put them back together, and those are the battlefield doctors. Now, there's not really a specialty of battlefield doctoring at this time, but in modern times, the various military services do have their own specially trained battlefield physicians. But I wanted to start off at the pretty much the oldest recorded history of battlefield medicine is in the medieval times. Now, remember, in medieval times, most of the weapons were swords. And so people would get cut up. So in order to keep people from getting cut up, they invented armor. Well, the armor was heavy, and the swords didn't work very well.
The heat, too. Can you imagine wearing an armor suit in Florida?
Well, I don't think we had the knights of old in Florida, but yes, I think the original Spanish people who came here, they wore chest armor, mainly to protect themselves from arrows and spears. Now, in the medieval times, when a battle would be going on between two opposing armies, the wounded were just left alone until the battle was over. And then when the prevailing army won the field of the day, they would go around and just kill all the people who were laying on the ground who were not dead yet. So that was really all there was to battlefield medicine. The earliest attempt to get the wounded off the field was in 1403 in the Battle of Shrewsbury, where Prince Henry had an arrow removed from his face using a specially designed surgical instrument, and he was quickly taken off the field. But that was the first recorded evidence of somebody actually getting treated on the field. So how do we get the wounded off the field? We need an ambulance, right? So the first ambulances were used in 1487. You wouldn't think that there were ambulances at that time. Of course, they weren't motorized, but they had horses. Horse and buggies and people to pull wheeled carts. And this was the first ambulance type vehicles were created by the Spanish, and that was the earliest recorded episodes of ambulances being used to take the wounded off the field. It was in 1487. So there was at least there was an attempt to try and save some people. Now, battlefield wounds were uniformly fatal, especially if there was any penetration of the chest or abdomen. Battlefield wounds of the extremities were frequently fatal if they required an amputation, and amputations were done in the 1500s.
Wow. Yeah. I always remember Gone with the Wind.
Right.
That was the Civil War.
And there was a French surgeon by the name of Andros Perret, who became very famous because of surgical techniques that he developed for France, and he served four kings of France for how to do an amputation, how to ligate a blood vessel, or how to put a dressing on a wound. There weren't very many medicines around except for what witchcraft and other home remedies. But most battlefield wounds were uniformly fatal up until the time of the American Civil War. And even in the American Civil War, the bullets that were used were rounded lead bullets. And if they came in contact with any part of your body, they would spread out and make a pretty big hole. And that's the reason why, for instance, we had so many amputations during the American Civil War.
Plus, they didn't know the techniques of antisepsis.
That's correct. The survival rate of a wounded soldier in the American Civil War was only about 10% or less. Any kind of a wound, most of the people died from infection. Now, during an amputation, it was a leg. About half those people died during the amputation. And if it was an arm, about 25% of those people died during the amputation. But another half of the people who survived the amputation died from infection because there was no antisepsis known. And the surgeons in the field up until almost 1870 didn't even wash their hands. If an instrument fell on the floor, they'd pick it up, maybe wipe it off with some kind of a rag that was either bloodied or full of some other bodily parts, and they would just continue to work. And remember also that when they did the amputation, they tied the major blood vessels off with horse hair.
Horse hair?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Instead of using cotton or, what we use today. And then all of a sudden, Lister came along, and he said, okay, guys, wash your hands. Lister and Semmelweis. And Semmelweis was not a surgeon. He was an OBGYN man in Vienna, and he proved that washing your hands saved lives. Now, it's hard to imagine that that was the state of medicine at that time, around 1850, 1860.
Well, a lot of women would die in childbirth because the OBGYN doctor would not wash their hands and take care of one patient, go to the next patient, and not even wash their hands.
Right. And that's what Semmelweis did.
Yeah, he had washed his hands.
Yeah, because he was an OBGYN guy, and he insisted that everybody who was delivering babies wash their hands between deliveries. And he cut the incidence of puerperal sepsis down from about 75% to 8 or 9% in one wing of a hospital that had many other wings. So his wing of the hospital had very few deaths, and the remaining wings of the hospital had a death rate of about 25% because childbirth was a very hazardous thing for a woman. Well, let's get back to the battlefield medicine. So after the American Civil War, we get into the next big war we had was the First World War. And in the First World War, when we went to war, there was no medical corps.
There was no medical corps.
There was no medical corps. Now, in the Civil War, there were probably about 30,000 people who called themselves doctors, of which only several hundred of them were really truly trained physicians.
During the American Revolutionary War.
Right.
That was even before that. That time.
Right. And the same thing was true during the American Revolution. They had like 3,500 people who called themselves doctors, but only 400 of them had ever been to school. And remember, medical schools in those days were only a 2-year program. And most people who called themselves doctors were indentured to another physician for 4 to 6 years.
Like an apprentice.
Like a guild. And that's how, and then they could get, they could then call themselves doctor because they were trained by Dr. X. Now, during the American, Civil War, there were some very observant physicians and who made some progress in giving care. And one of them was, is known in our circles as the father of battlefield medicine, Jonathan Letterman. And Letterman Hospital was named after him. And
where is that at?
I think I'm not 100% sure where that is. I think it's out on the West Coast someplace, but I'm not sure. But I know there is a Letterman Army Hospital. In the First World War, we still didn't have much in the way of antibiotics. And the First World War, if you remember from the movies and all, was predominantly a trench war.
And they had gas.
Yeah, and we sent something like 400,000, almost 400,000 men over to the to fight and to help fight the Germans in the First World War, and we had about 120,000 casualties, death casualties of that that numbers of men, mainly because once again, if you had any kind of a wound, it was most likely fatal.
But didn't most of the people after World War One passed? Also because of the influenza virus after the war and killed many people.
Oh, sure. We had all kinds of diseases. And actually, in fact, through the ages, more people have died from infection than have died from war wounds. Like, for instance, malaria has disabled more armies and killed more soldiers than have ever been killed by other soldiers. Now, as we go on, after the First World War, we get into the Second World War, and by the time the Second World War had come around, antibiotics were on their way. There was penicillin, there were sulfur drugs, and the battle battlefield deaths began to be reduced from, let's say, 90% to maybe 35% to 40%, and then in the Korean War, we developed a concept of having hospitals in the battlefield, the MASH unit, the Military Army's Surgical Hospital. That was the first MASH unit, and it was very much like what we see on TV, because when I was in the military, we had such a hospital in a crate at our base. And then, and those soldiers that were not actually killed outright on the battlefield, if they got to a MASH hospital, they got to a military, and they were evacuated within an hour of their wound, they had a 90% survival. So we went from a 90% fatality rate to a 90% survival rate. And that's about the way it is today. If a soldier is wounded on the field, on the battlefield, and gets to an aid station somewhere within an hour, he has a 90% chance of surviving that wound.
Well, that's really something. But also to think that the people who are evacuating the wounded are also, besides the wounded, are during the heat of the battle, are also risking their lives. Those ambulances.
Right. Well, now we use most of the battlefield ambulances today are helicopters. The first helicopter used was in 1944 in Burma. And then, as you all know from news and the movies and whatever, their helicopters are really the main evacuation vehicle. And, of course, once the soldier's in the helicopter and the helicopter's away from the firing zone, the wounded can get care quickly, both on the helicopter. And now, the other thing that's happened is that the use of modern techniques in the current era has dramatically increased the skills that are available to a wounded soldier on the field. There is access to experts using the internet. There's access. Some military hospitals actually have robotic medicine that can be operated from somebody in Washington or Baltimore on a soldier who happens to be in a hospital ship or something like that.
Wow.
So that the availability of modern medical techniques has really expanded dramatically. And one very interesting thing that I saw doing this reading this week was a product called DARPA, D-A-R-P-A. And what it is if a soldier's wounded in the belly, it's very, very difficult to know where that blood is coming from. And with DARPA, on the battlefield, an injection can be made of this material, which expands in the belly, and it's like a foam. And this foam compresses the major blood vessels and the minor blood vessels of the bowel to control bleeding on the field.
Wow.
And they estimate that probably they can save half the patients who have died from battlefield injuries to the abdomen. Now, the other thing that's happened during the last 50 or 100 years is the development of body armor. So we're right kind of back to where we were in the medieval area. But body armor today is not made out of metal. It's made out of a combination of different materials, which will stop the penetrating effect of a bullet. And as you can see as well from the news and the movies and whatever, that body armor is in common use today.
That's very interesting. We're about ready for our break, and we want you to continue, Dr. Katzen.
Well, thank you.
This is really interesting. So we have really evolved, and I haven't heard anybody about what body part am I. Do I need to give more clues?
That was
clues?
Really a stumper. I think you need to give them just a little bit of clues.
You want to give some clues?
Well, sure. Well, this part of the brain lies below another part of the brain, and it's the first portion of its name is hypo. Hypo meaning below, but it is also above where the nerves of vision come into the brain from your eye. But it's a very important part because it controls so much, including your appetite.
Okay, we've given another clue. Come on, somebody. You got to call and give us the answer. We'll take our little break.
You're listening to The Slippery Slope of Lipids and Other Medical Issues, brought to you by the Triana Prevention Center in Port Charlotte. We encourage you to visit their new website, which is trianapreventioncenter.com. That's T-R-I-A-N-A Prevention Center, all one word, .com. If you'd like to catch up on previous shows, there's an archive going back to the beginning of this program covering a wide variety of topics. Dr. Triana is accepting new patients currently and will ask the doctor to give her number out in just a little bit. In the meantime, if you'd like to call this program, our numbers are 941-206-1580 and toll-free at 888-441-1580. And now, back to Dr. Elizabeth Triana and Dr. Katzen.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Zane. Yesterday, I was getting my nails done, and I met some very nice ladies, and I talked about all the different services we offer in our office. And one of them is that we are now able to draw blood and send it out for advanced hormone testing. So why is this important? Well, this is very important, the hormones, in how you age, in how your body functions. And if you listen to What Body Part Am I, this part of your brain, it again is the leader of the orchestra. So if no one guesses it, we'll give you the answer and we'll tell you what that body part really does. But I think it's really important to know that with checking your levels of hormone, it is a much better assessment of your physiological state. And therefore, for example, when people complain of menopause, fatigue, hair loss, dry skin, decreased libido, all these issues we can help you with. I can help you with at the Triana Prevention Center, and we can check blood. And that also has to do with staying healthy.
That's correct. The whole concept of knowing where your hormones are is to be able to make some adjustment and kind of bring you back to an earlier stage in your life when the amount of various hormones was circulating at a little bit higher level, which meant your skin had greater turgor, you had more hair, you had a better appetite, better libido, and also we were more active physically.
The good old days.
Yes, and right. if the person needs hormones, we use bioidentical. Again, I want everyone to understand, what is a bioidentical hormone? It is the hormone that your body produces.
Right, it's chemically exactly the same. And it may be artificially produced, but it's exactly the same chemical that your body would produce.
The same chemical. So with bioidenticals, we are giving you what your body used to produce, and we're controlling those levels at a physiological range. In other words, before people would give hormones, they never checked any blood. They just gave too much. And that's part of the problems that occurred when levels were not checked. There is so much advancement in this area, so much science and research, that it isn't just one size fits all. And haven't I been talking about this over and over again? My practice is personalized to you, the patient. I'm not the same as anyone else, and I don't think you are. We're all different. We all respond different to medications. Our physiology is different. Our hormone levels are different. Our age is different.
That's correct. And one of the things that hormone evaluation allows you to do is to set some goals as to where you want the patient to be, some definite goals. Some people might have be two-thirds there and only need one-third additional stimulation in one area or another. Another person might be 10% of what their ideal level should be.
And this is a fascinating field that incorporates prevention. We are trying to prevent disease before it happens. Or we, as in the Amy Donin, who was on the show, we are looking for disease. We're not waiting for the catastrophic events that can result from disease.
That's correct. I mean, it's in every area of the body, especially in the vascular arena, where we all have almost everybody has some vascular disease, and it is the largest.
And it looks like we have a caller. Hi, caller. Hi, caller.
Hi. Two things. The body part is hypothalamus.
Yay! Thank you. You got it.
And the hospital Letterman was on the Presidio in San Francisco.
Oh,
thank you for that.
Thank you. So have you been there then?
I'm sorry, what?
Oh, how interesting. Well, thank you so much, and a happy Memorial Day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, that's really wonderful. She knows where that hospital was. That's really great. You know, the other day we watched this movie called Captain Phillips with Tom Hanks, and when you see our military and all the wonderful things they do, it just makes your heart, it just pound, and you become so proud.
That's correct. I mean, that's that's one of the things that we have to remember at Memorial Day, that we're remembering those people who made the ultimate sacrifice and didn't come back.
You know, I feel very blessed that I'm a provider for, I have patients who are in the military, and I'm on their insurance plan. So it's such an honor to take care of veterans and retired military patients. And when I listen to their stories, I'm just in awe. And you, and Zane, you said your father was also a veteran.
Yeah, my dad landed on Utah Beach on D-Day.
Wow.
So, yeah, this is back in 44.
And Dr. Katzen, your father, too.
Yeah, he my dad landed on, I don't remember which beach he landed on, but he was in the Normandy invasion.
And when I took my dad to see Saving Private Ryan, the beginning of that, my dad was in tears, and he said that is how just how it was. He said the only thing missing was the smell of gunpowder.
Right. Right.
Oh, so, my goodness.
Yeah.
My dad was a foot soldier, and he spoke German fluently. And until they got to taking German prisoners, he had a pretty rough time. But after they started taking German prisoners, they needed somebody who could talk to them. And so it made his life a lot easier. But he was also in the Battle of the Bulge, where there were Germans.
Yeah, my dad was too.
Who were trained and who went to school in the United States, who were dressed up in U.S. Army uniforms trying to infiltrate behind our lines.
That I saw a movie one time where they showed that. That's terrible.
Well, I mean, all's fair in love and war.
Well, I know that your father also, you said your father was also liberated some of the concentration camps.
Yeah,
he was there.
Yeah, at the end. He was there during that. So, and, you know, he talked very little about that because, you know, all these years, you know, understandably shocked. You know, it's very heart-wrenching and sad to watch it on TV or in the movies, but to actually be there and see it, oh my.
Well, the thing is I think that we have to realize that we're all humans, and when humans do bad things to other humans, that's the most saddest of all to me.
It is.
Well, so
almost every soldier that I've ever come in contact with doesn't want to talk about any battle.
Doesn't want to talk about a battle?
No.
It's very stressful.
Well, sure, because they have to relive their personal experience.
But we should, like, and Memorial Day is a day to say thank you, because if it wasn't for our military and all that they've gone through, you know, we're very blessed to be free.
Yes, we are. I mean, when you think about, you know, when you live, a lot of these guys, I'm 47 right now, and I think, you know, these guys didn't make it past 20, 21. You know, a lot of them didn't. And to miss all those years and all those experiences, if you think of it in those terms, just day-to-day living, they were, you know, they gave that up just so that we could, you know, be free. And
I have a personal experience of family members that live in Cuba. And let me tell you, they are not free. And it's a terrible thing to have to worry about that your children may not even get milk, you know, basic necessities, because everything is controlled by the government. But this is not a political show. This is a medical. So, but we want to thank our service people, men, women, all those out there that have served the country. And we thank you.
One little thing I can tell you, Dr. Katzen, that ties into what we're talking about with battle time and the way, not only the way that they treated our wounded soldiers, but the way they prepared them for battle. I can remember my dad talking about when he took his basic training in Macon, Georgia, they would give them water and lemonade, but they would have this lemonade and they would insist that they take salt pellets. That's what they did before they had Gatorade, you know, so they would do that.
Oh, they gave, really?
Yeah, back before they, to replace the electrolytes.
That was pretty common in the South. When I was growing up in Miami, when we were on the football field or whatever, taking salt and water was really kind of a routine thing.
Well, I grew up here in Florida, and I don't remember doing that, but...
But I don't think you played football either.
No. I was a bookworm.
But
I should've.
That time, they had Gatorade, I think.
No, I'm 56 years. Well, I'm giving my age over the air.
Whoa.
I'm 56 years old, so I'm very proud of my age.
Well, remember, Gatorade was invented at the University of Florida in Gainesville.
Gainesville.
Yes. And talking about the hypothalamus, since we're on that subject, you know, when you get stressed out, that affects your brain. And the hypothalamus works on telling the pituitary gland, also that produces hormones like vasopressin that works on the kidneys. So when you have the hypothalamus not reacting correctly, or if the pituitary gland isn't doing its job, you can imagine even at the most basic level of electrolytes in your body can be altered.
That's correct. And how can you damage the hypothalamus? Well, it's in the center of the brain. So if you have a blow to the head, you can have the hypothalamus kind of shut down for a while. If you have a brain tumor and have radiation therapy that includes the hypothalamus will shut down for a while. And even we know some patients that have had radiation therapy, and after the radiation therapy, they have no desire to eat, so they lose weight for about 6 months. Then it all comes back.
And the other thing to remember, there's a lot of research now on traumatic brain injury. What is that? A blow to the head. Maybe you have suffered a concussion. Maybe the concussion, you also totally passed out. You know, you also, people who are boxers, they have traumatic brain injury. Football players. And they're finding out that this affects the hypothalamus, which then affects the pituitary gland. So there is so much research about your hormone levels. Even people who not only played sports, but may have been in certain type of carnival rides.
That's correct. I mean, because in some of the carnival rides, you get G-forces, like in a fighter pilot. And some of those G-forces are 3 to 4 times your weight. And that's what a G-force is. And some people may have some impending weakness, and because they're subject to these G-forces, can have an injury, whereas a normal person might not have an injury, and you can't tell by looking at people.
You know, I, being a menopause, I'm a certified menopause practitioner, and as a lipidologist, and all this comes together with the orchestra of hormones, and how important it is. The leader of the band, the hypothalamus, the pituitary gland, the other glands in your body. It is just, I just think it's incredible. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, well, the hypothalamus is so small, and to imagine it has such a big job is really quite something else.
And it's connected to other parts of the brain. The way, so when somebody says to you, body, mind, and spirit, you are connected totally.
That's correct. And people have studied the relationship between the heart and the brain, too, which is not necessarily in the heart, obviously, is not in the head, but there is a tremendous effect. There's a tremendous feedback mechanism between the heart and the brain.
Yes, there's a lot of chemicals that the heart produces when it's been injured, and that also affects the brain, and it all communicates.
That's correct.
And it's so fascinating. So when, and also it's good to know that there's certain medications that can also affect our hormone levels. And that's why at the Triana Prevention Center, we check those levels. For years, we've been, you know, checking thyroid levels and thinking, conventional, practice has been that people will check your thyroid. Well, there's a lot more out there than your thyroid.
That's correct. There's all every part of your body is controlled by these hormones that are released from the pituitary that the release hormones are produced in the hypothalamus.
And the book that I'm going to be having a guest, Dr. Maupin, and she wrote this book, which is. I talked about it before. It's called The Secret Female Hormone, How Testosterone Replacement for Women Can Change Their Life. It is a great book. I really recommend. Boy, I wish we had a book club on the air so everybody could read the book and call in and ask questions. You know, when I talk about a book on the air, I've read the book. I'm not just talking about it, or I'm in the process of reading it. So if I recommend it, believe me, and I'm a bookworm. I love to read. Big time bookworm.
I know that.
big time bookworm. I love to read. I just and my patients know that too. And I even have the books in the office, and I show them the books. I said, this book is important. Need to read this book. And many books, you know, now we can Kindle it.
Sure. I'm not 100% sure that the Malpin book is on Kindle. I think it is. I think it is. It's about, and on Kindle it's about $8, something like that.
Well, Outliving Your Ovaries by Dr. Marina Johnson is.
It is on Kindle.
And, you know, I have to say, I am getting more and more people saying they're listening to the show. And I just received an email from a doctor in California who wrote a book on childhood obesity. So we're going to talk and see if she's going to be on the show, too.
I think that should be a very interesting show. And it really is very timely, too, because childhood obesity turns into adult obesity.
And diabetes.
Right.
And, you know, that's the other problem is that we, many people don't realize and think that just being overweight is just, you know, fat. A fat cell just stores fat. But no, a fat cell also produces different types of hormones, messengers that affect the rest of your body.
Yes, the fat cells want to stay fat. And if you start to reduce, one of the reasons why you're so uncomfortable is because the fat cells are saying, give me fat, give me fat. And the brain turns that into hunger.
Well, let me tell you, with this low-carb diet that I'm doing, most of the time if I'm hungry, I will tell you it's psychological. Remember, hunger has the hypothalamus affected. Hunger is affected by insulin, your high levels of insulin. There's also certain hormones that are given out by your stomach.
That's correct.
And these hormones tell you if you're full, if you're not full. And also there is a psychological component. There is a habit kind of feeling. Like, I know me, I like to have a little snack, like around 10 o'clock at night before I go to bed. So I found, again, as I spoke before, cottage cheese or a little half of a serving of just plain yogurt. I was also doing some almonds, but I got a little carried away. So now no almonds.
I like this stuff called, I don't know what you're going to say about this either, but it's something that bodybuilders use. It's a very popular protein drink called Muscle Milk.
Oh, yes.
Is that okay for us? I mean, I don't know if there's Splenda in there or not.
I don't know the ingredients in there, but protein is good.
32 grams per serving. So
yeah,
that's really.
EAS has 17 grams per serving and 100 calories. That's another snack that people can have. It's a high protein snack.
But most of the high protein snacks, and I'm not sure that the Muscle Milk, whether the Muscle Milk does or not, come from milk protein.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have to look also at the carbohydrate. For me, you know, some of those supplements, like some, if you ever look at those supplement bars, like the protein bars, some of them have tons of carbohydrates in them, like 45 grams, 35 grams.
And that's like having a candy bar.
I know. So, I mean, you have to read what you're, again, it goes back to reading, looking at your labels.
Oh, I was just going to say, I love egg whites, too. I get that where they separate the whites from the eggs, and I have those in the morning. That's fantastic.
Well, you know, one egg a day is not going to hurt you if you monitor your cholesterol. There's minerals also. There is cholesterol in the egg white, about 270 milligrams of cholesterol. So you do have to watch that. And, you know, again, if you read the Beat the Heart Attack Gene book, if you look, the genetic testing that's done, the ApoE gene also will affect the way you metabolize your food.
Right. And remember, cholesterol is a very important product in the body. Most of the hormones are using the cholesterol molecule. And so you don't want your cholesterol to get down too low because you'll starve another productive system of your body.
Which is another thing, yes, cholesterol is the basis for your building block for your hormones. So everything, again, is a balance. It's a balance, which, you know, people get all kinds of myths about certain types of hormones, and they're bad for this, they're bad for that. But you really need to look and keep a balance. And that's what we're trying to do with the patients, and help them to understand, why are we doing this? Why are we trying to prevent disease?
That's right.
So, Dr. Katzen, to recap your battlefield medicine, it is amazing. I know that we went to a conference, and the doctor was an interventional radiologist who put stents in patients in the battlefield when they broke an artery.
Right. You know, each war has its own sort of favorite wound. And in the Iraq and Afghanistan arena, where there's so many wounds caused by IUD, which stands for improvised explosive device, the wounds are generally to the legs. And so the fellas, when the soldiers go out on patrol, they have a loose tourniquet at their groin that's ready if they happen to encounter an improvised device and it blows up their vehicle. Now, the vehicles are better now than when it all started, because they have a lot more armor on them. But some of the explosives are very powerful and will blow a pretty good-sized vehicle well into the air. And if these guys have a wound to their limb, they'll tighten the tourniquet right then and preserve their blood, which is a long way from where medicine was 500 or 600 years ago, when people thought that letting blood was a good thing, because if people had fever, they obviously had too much blood.
Well, you know, we've come a long way, and it's really right. Fantastic that so many lives can be saved with all the modern technology and research and study.
Right, and the interventional radiologist is in the hospitals that are where the wounded soldiers have come, and there are no more MASH hospitals. The hospitals now are called TACEVAC, which stands for Tactical Evacuation Care. Tactical Evacuation Care. And there is where this radiologist who we heard operates. But just imagine somebody's got a torn blood vessel in the leg. He can put a tube in the leg, inflate a balloon to stop the flow of blood just proximal to the injury, and then the surgeon can work in a bloodless field to repair the vessel.
That's amazing. The pictures that he showed of what they did to save these young men and women were so moving.
Sure. And it's... You wouldn't think that sort of a sophistication would be out in the field, but it is, and it's very, you know, it does save lives, and it helps reduce morbidity, too.
That's so important. Morbidity, mortality, illness, and, you know, that's another thing I tell my patients. You know, we are trying to help prevent you from becoming disabled, to be around with your family members, for more good years.
That's correct. That's more good years is the thing. No, we can't stop anybody from aging, because your birthday, the clock keeps going. But we can just help you live a lot better.
And, you know, that's really important. I think everyone wants that. Wants to be around, to be with their grandchildren, their children, to be around for those milestone events, to enjoy life with their life partners. Husband, wife, spouse, you know, that's really important.
Well, I think that's a very human thing, isn't it? I mean, it's...
Very human, very important. So I want everyone to understand the hypothalamus is very important. It's the leader of the orchestra. We know that there's a link between your nervous system to your endocrine system, which we said, and we have a caller. Hello, caller.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
One thing I'm surprised you didn't mention when you were pushing protein something I just learned.
Yes?
There's good protein and there's bad protein as far as I'm concerned. I have kidney disease, and my doctor tells me I cannot have protein more than once a week, and a meat protein, animal protein.
Uh-huh.
I never knew that there was protein available that wasn't from animal.
Oh, yes.
Well, the vegetarians get most of their protein from soy.
Yeah, I've become a vegetarian since I was diagnosed with stage 4 kidney disease.
Right. And there's protein in beans. Protein and carbohydrate. Garbanzo beans, black beans, red beans. I love beans. So that's really wonderful, caller. Thank you so much. You have any other questions?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Happy Memorial Day.
So would whey and casein protein be considered a non-vegetarian? I mean, because it comes from milk, does that...
It's animal.
That's animal, so that's out.
Most of the vegetarians get most of their protein from soy.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, you have to... Again, each one of us is different. Some people can have cannot eat whey protein. You have to see. Some people are allergic to soy, too.
Well, we should respond somewhat to the caller, because people with severe kidney disease want to limit the amount of protein because it puts an extra metabolic load on the kidney.
Then that's very important. And we know, too, caller, that if you have stage 4 kidney disease or any type of kidney disease, this puts you in a higher risk category for vascular disease, heart attack, stroke. So that's another indicator why you also need to be assessed.
That's correct.
For vascular disease, because you're at high risk. Also, we know that many diabetics have kidney disease, vascular disease.
Yes. I mean, the diabetics have advanced vascular disease, and very commonly, just having diabetes has put you at the same risk as somebody's had a heart attack.
Correct. And we need to look also the kidney. One of the things we do also with diabetics and anyone who has high blood pressure, because we know the high blood pressure affects the kidneys, we do a urine test called a spot urine, where we check, well, what is the kidney? The kidney also filters. And if we see that your body is throwing little micro protein particles, well, that filter system is not working well. So we call that a spot urine for microalbumin. And this is also another indicator of your kidney function.
That's correct. That's...
So this is all, everything in our body is interrelated. It is a wonderful, I just feel so blessed to be able to take care of my patients and to bring this information to all of you who are listening.
That's correct. The kidneys, are a filter. And what happens in the kidney is the blood that comes into the kidney, almost all of the liquid portion is excreted, and then the kidney then metabolically reabsorbs what it needs to stabilize your body.
So I want to thank everyone. Thank you for listening. Happy Memorial Day. Thank you, callers. And remember, this is Dr. Elizabeth Triana with Dr. Katzen. This is the Slippery Slope of Lipids and Other Medical Issues live. So I want everyone to know, don't go down that slippery slope. Let's stay healthy. Thank you.